So I'm happy to be back again. We've seen each other a short while ago. And the topic we will be discussing in the coming hour will be a very pressing issue. But before starting, I would like to take this opportunity to thank one of the very special people in this room and a very special friend, Dr. Geisler, and his gracious wife for really making this happen. Dr. Geisler initiated the Association for the Advancement of Medical Halacha, and he actually has been with us since the very first conference and since we originally discussed this halacha. So Dr. Dan Geisler and his gracious wife have been tremendous friends and great supporters, and I thank you from the depth of my heart. We should share Besedus Tovis, and we should have the schus together to be Mekadish Shem Shemaim, and you should have nachas from your family. So one of the troubling issues that we deal with recently in the context of end-of-life shilas questions, terminal sedation has become accepted practice in many circles, not in the Frum community, but in many circles. And as many other phenomena in contemporary modern society, some very well-known celebrities underwent terminal sedation and in a very public manner said their goodbyes to their friends and families before being put to sleep, literally. And that has created somewhat of a trend. And the question is, what are the limits? On one hand, we do administer morphine to terminally ill patients, especially cancer patients that are in extreme suffering and pain. And many doctors argue that we are aware that administering a high dosage of morphine might shorten one's life. Would that be different than intentionally bringing forth terminal sedation? So this sugya probably starts off with a medrash, and it is uncommon that a medrash would sort of a major halachic discussion. So on Bava Kamad of Tzadik Aleph, the Gemara says that committing suicide is a grave transgression. Beis Din is not authorized to punish someone that committed suicide. Well, as we could imagine, Beis Din has very limited means to do so. However, it is an Aveira Chamura. It is a grave transgression. And the Gemara learns this from the Pasuk, Va'achas dimchem lenafshei seichem edroish. So the Medrash says, Yochoel kishaul, would this transgression, would this Aveira apply to Shaul HaMelech? Talmud loimer ach. Ach is a mute. So the Melech Shaul had justification for committing suicide. And that story is told in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Lamed Aleph, Vatichbada Milchama El Shaul, Vyimtzeu Hamoirim Anoshim Bekeshes, Vyochel Moid Mahamorim, Vyoyme Shaul and Oisekelov. Shlav charbachu vidakreinu ba, pen yavou ha'arilim ha'ele, vidakrani v'yitalelu bi. So Shaul asked his servant, take your sword and stab me, kill me. I don't want the Pelishtim, sheyitalelu bi. V'lo yavou noisekelov ki yorei ma'oid. And his servant was afraid, he was terrified. V'yikach Shaul esacherev v'yepol aleya. So Chazal do seem to suggest in the Medrash that Shaul was entitled to do so. And some halachic authorities want to prove from this Medrash that when a person is afraid of suffering, he is entitled to destroy his life. And the question would be, if he is entitled to do so, would others be entitled as well to help him along and to assist him to take his life? So, how do we deal with a halacha which would have 6 or 7 different interpretations? And how do we decide which of those 6 or 7 interpretations would be accepted ruling? So, there are 2 different Tosfosim. One is a Masechet Gittin Daf Nun Zayin, and the other is an Avodah Zarah Daf Yud Ches. In Gittin Daf Nun Zayin, Tosfos seems to indicate, yes, a person is entitled to take his life if he is afraid of pain and suffering. However, in Avodah Zarah Daf Yud Ches, the interpretation of Tosfos is a different one, telling the story in Gittin Yud Zayin of 400 children that were taken by the Romans into custody, and they all jumped off the ship, off the boat, and they drowned. So the interpretation of Tosfos and Gittin was that they were afraid of pain. But in Avodah Zarah, Tosfos has a different approach. They were afraid that they would be forced to violate the Gimel Avedas Chamura Shebetoira, and that would justify taking their life, not pain per se. Some of the Mefarshim on the Medrash say that Shaul was aware, and he heard that from Shmuel Anavi, that he will be killed by the Pelishtim, and that entitled him to be preemptive and to take his own life. The Maharshal, one of the greatest halachic authorities in Yamshel Shloime, Perek Chesem Bavakama, writes, Shaul judged that the king of Israel falling into the captivity of the Pelishtim would in itself be defined as a Chilul Hashem, and to prevent V'lo Yisechalalu Hashem Kachi, he was entitled to take his life. And then the Marshal suggests, I think that's a spark of genius, and the Marshal suggests, as if he would be one of Chazal, and the Marshal suggests that maybe Shaul, knowing the Jewish warriors, knowing his army, was afraid if he would be captive by the Pelishtim, then the Jewish army, the Israeli army, would fight a desperate battle, a hopeless battle, and thousands will be killed in that battle. And to save those thousands of Jewish lives, Shaul preferred to take his own life. So we have 5 or 6 different suggestions. How do we understand the story told in Avi and Sefer Shmuel that Shaul took his own life? So on one hand, yes, we have 1 Tosfos, 2 Tosfos, Yefei Toyar, V'Shachan Debach, in Yoredei Kuf Nin Zayin, and those are the major poskim. They accept the interpretation that we find in Avodah Zarah Daf Yud Ches. Shaul was afraid that he would be coerced to idol worshipping, and that was the justification of committing suicide. So the Shach and the Bach are poiskim, not merely Rishonim, and according to their interpretation, there would be no room for leniency committing suicide to prevent pain and suffering. I also think that it is obvious from the wording, from the formulation of the Shulchan Aruch, and I quote from Shulchan Aruch in Hilchos Aveilos Simen Shin Mem Hei, Katan hama'abed atzmo ledaat, when a minor would commit suicide, choshuv kishaloi ledaat, if it would be a minor, then we treat him with the total respect and honor that we treat any other person after his demise. V'chein gadol ha-ma'abed atzmo ledas v'hu onus kishol ha-melech ein munin mimeno kol davar. So the Shulchan Aruch says that shaul was defined as an oynes. Oynes is not a heter. It's only a ptur. So I think according to a sif in Shulchan Aruch, shaul wasn't justified in taking his life. But we cannot judge him. When a person takes his life out of total desperation, out of being terrified and afraid of pain and suffering, we cannot judge him. That would be defined as an oynes. And therefore, he deserves the proper respect that we give to every person after his demise. So what we learn from this sif in Shulchan Aruch, it's a din oynes and not a heter. So only the person himself could be defined as an oynes. That would not justify any other person in assisting one in taking his life. So there's a famous story, somewhat a baffling story, told in Avodah Zorah Daf Yud Ches about Reb Chanina ben Taradion, one of the greatest Tanoim, who was one of the Haruge Malchus. So Reb Chanina ben Taradion, like his friends, Reb Akiva, Reb Yishmuel, Reb Shimon, was tortured and murdered and killed by the Romans. And as the story is told in Avodah Zorah Daf Yud Ches, he was wrapped in a Sefer Torah and burnt at stake. And the Talmidim were standing there around him. And it is a most moving description that we find in the Gemara, the Kiddush Hashem of one of the great Tanoim, Reb Chanina ben Taradion. And the Talmidim ask him, Rabbi, ma tu roya, what do you see? And he says, Gvile nisrofin va'oisi es parchois. And then the Talmidim plead with him, Af ato psach picho v'yekones b'chuhu eish. They couldn't see their great Rabbi suffering. So they plead with him, inhale, maybe you'll inhale the smoke and it'll hasten your demise and you wouldn't suffer that much. And he responds by saying, Mutav yitlena mishon asono va'al yechabel bi'atzmoy. I will not do anything to hasten my demise, to shorten my life. And then Kalatz Tanuri, who obviously was the executioner, and he was a young non-Jewish lad. And he asks the great Tana, Imani marbe b'shehves v'noitel svugin shel tzemer mi'al libcho. Do you promise to bring me l'chaye olam haba? And Reb Chanina ben Taradion says, yes. If you will stoke the fire and hasten my death, I will bring you to chaye olam haba. And Kalatz Tanuri, that young non-Jew, asks Reb Chanina ben Taradion to swear, and he swears. And that is what he did. V'yotze nishmosoi b'tahara. So that's the story as told in the Gemara. What do we make of this story? Is this a raya that a person is entitled to shorten his life and hasten his death? Or the contrary? So Reb Moshe Nigras Moshe, Choshe Mishpot Chelik Beisim and Ayin Dalet, tries to interpret the story. What do we learn from here? And Reb Moshe learns, this proves that it is a prohibition. It's an isser to hasten one's death. Even in the gravest and most dire situations, even though when he is suffering like Yesurei Iyov, he is being burned and he refuses to inhale and bring about his demise. So how do we understand that Reb Chanina ben Taradion promises and swears to Kalatz Tanuri, but if you will stoke the fire and hasten my death, I promise I'll bring you to Chaye Olam Haba? So Reb Moshe says, well, it's only a question of lifnei iver. So maybe he wasn't choshesh to lifnei iver. And maybe a non-Jew, even though murder is one of the Sheva Mitzvahs b'nei noyach, but maybe murder in the Sheva Mitzvahs has a different definition than murder in Din Yisroel. But to me, that approach is not very reasonable. Because when a person makes a shaliach, whether he's Jewish or not, to kill, whether himself or any other party, That is not merely dealing with Lifna Yivel Oisit and Michshol. The Rambam makes it clear in Perek Beis of Hilchas Roitzeach, he would be considered a murderer, and he is chayev misa biyadei shomayim. Ein shliach ledvar avera. So Beis Din wouldn't have the authority to judge him, but he would be chayev misa biyadei shomayim. So when Abchanina ben Taradian asks Klatz Tenuri, yes, I promise, if you will hasten my demise and bring it forth, then I swear I'll bring you to Chai Olam Abo. He encouraged him to shorten his life. If this is a prohibition, how did he do it? Al Yedei Goy. Still would be a Chiyav of Misa Bedei Shayim. So I think this story would prove the contrary. It would prove that, yes, it would be permissible halachically. However, Reb Chanina ben Taradian wanted no part of it himself, but that was merely Midas Chassidus. And I think that is also the formulation, the way Reb Chanina ben Taradian said it. Mutav yitlena mishena sono va'al yechabel ba'atzmoy. That doesn't sound like a prohibition. Reb Chanina ben Taradian says, if you do it, I promise and I swear I'll be in Golachai Olam Habo. But I will not initiate, and I will not do it myself. So what do we make of this story? Not much. I think that a situation in which a person is burning and there is no chance and no way in which he could be saved. Death is imminent and immediate. So it'll take seconds, minutes, that might be a different situation. There's a similar story told in a Doron Daf Chof Beis about Ula was going on his way and he was accompanied by two people, two hoodlums, gangsters, robbers, cannibals, we don't know who they were, but obviously very violent men. And one cut the throat of his friend and he turns to Ula, one of the great Amoraim, and he says, what do you say? Did I do the right thing? And Ula responds, of course you did the right thing. Go ahead. And then when he comes to Rabbi Yochanan, he has terrible pangs of a guilty conscience. And he tells the story to Rabbi Yochanan. Maybe I encouraged the person to kill. And Rabbi Yochanan says, no. It was over by the time he turned to you. He already cut his friend's throat. And if you wouldn't respond, he might have killed you as well. So what do we make of this story? So was a person entitled to kill to save himself? No. So if a person already had his throat cut and he was gasping for the last breaths of life, maybe in that situation, it would no longer be defined as Ritzich. So I think these two stories that we find in the Gemara have some common denominator. In both situations, the person in all practicality was already murdered. It was a matter of seconds, maybe a minute or two. He was gravely injured. So maybe it's not a heter, but that would no longer be defined as a ritzich. Stories are stories, and we cannot really learn halacha. The only way we learn halacha is from the interpretation that we find in the Rishonim to stories that are told in Chazal. And in these two sugyas, we do not find the Rishonim dealing with the questions of life and death, with the questions of pikuach nefesh. So in my opinion, it is more reasonable to conclude and say, in the story of Reb Chanina ben Taradian, as well as the story told in Adorim. No, probably it wouldn't be defined as Ritzicha. If it would be defined as Ritzicha, Reb Chanina ben Taradian wouldn't ask Klatz Tanuri to do it to him. However, could we learn from here that when a person is ill, he is entitled to take his life? No. I think when a person is ill, as grave as his situation may be, it is not the same as a person who had his throat cut open or a person that is already burned to the bone. So I don't think we could take any halakha conclusion from either of these two sugyas. Which brings us back to the story of Shaul HaMelech. So my conclusion is, in no circumstances is a person entitled by halachic criteria to commit suicide, whether he is suffering or not. Kal v'chomer, that there would be no permit at all to assist the person to take his life. And therefore, terminal sedation would in no circumstances be permissible by halachic criteria. Which brings us back to the question of treating terminally ill patients who are in extreme suffering. And sometimes there comes a stage which it all boils down to palliative medicine. There is no longer much we could do. There is no longer a chance for a cure. We just try to maintain and treat pain. And the most potent tool in treating pain are drugs, and that's morphine. And we know that morphine does impair the breathing, the pulmonary activity, because it affects the brain stem. Would that be permissible or not? So what I know is Maaseh Rav, the two great halachic giants of our generation that I quoted in our previous shiur, Reb Moshe and Reb Shlomo Zalman. So Reb Avigdor Neventzal, one of the Choshev Rabbonim we have in Yerushalayim, who is a dear friend to me, and I heard from him that he discussed this question with Reb Shlomo Zalman, and Reb Shlomo Zalman said, as long as our motive, what we're trying to do is caring and treating pain, and not chas v'sholem hastening a person's demise, even though maybe that will happen, that is a mitzvah and not an aveir. In no way would it be defined as terminal sedation. And I have a very dear friend in Yerushalayim who is Professor Yaakov Rau, who was one of the senior doctors in Shari Tzedek Hospital, and we're privileged to have a doctor like him on board. And he was studying medicine in New York, and he visited Reb Moshe many, many years ago as a young doctor in his stage. And he asked Reb Moshe this very question, and Reb Moshe responded in the same way. If you're careful with your dosage, and you try to keep the dose down to a minimum that is necessary to take care of pain, then that is a mitzvah. And that is the mitzvah of Ashuvah Saveda and Gemilas Chesed of administering medicine. And in no way would it be defined as an aveda. Which brings to mind an amazing interpretation on a chiddush of the Chazon Ish. In Choshe Mishpot, Mesechet Sanhedrin, Zimachof Hei. So the Chazon Ish deals with a question at the time which might have been imaginary. When a person shot an arrow, and if we do not interfere, that arrow will kill many people. We could turn it in another direction. Well, how do you turn an arrow after you shot it from your bow? But you could turn a missile in any direction you wish. And that is already almost obsolete military hardware. For decades, we have anti-tank missiles and other missiles that we control. So you shot a missile, and if we don't intervene, many people will be killed. You could turn it in either direction, but still, someone will be killed. So I heard from one of the disciples of the Chazon Ish, David Frankel, who was around many years ago, and he remembers when the Chazon Ish wrote that paragraph. And actually, yes, it was a question halacha lemaisa. It was a truck driver, and the brakes were not functioning. He couldn't stop his truck, but he did control the steering wheel. And if he wouldn't swerve right or left, tens of people might have been killed. So he turned left and he killed a person whose life was not in danger. And then he came to the Chazon Ish to ask for a tikkun shuv. He actually killed a person. And the Chazon Ish told him that by halachic criteria, he would not be defined as one that killed a person. Because the other option would be destroying many lives. That is what he had to do. So the Chazon Ish has an amazing definition. And he writes, that is a maisa rachmoni and not a maisa achzori. So we could see his act and define it in two ways. We could say he saved many lives. Yes, but by saying the many, he destroyed the few. Would that be considered murder? Would that be considered an act of aggression, an act of destroying life? Or would that be considered an act of hatsola? So the Chazon Ish argues that would be considered an act of hatsola. So sometimes with the purest of intentions, and we are trying to perform a mitzvah, and that is easing the terrible pain and suffering of an individual, of a person that desperately needs our help. But maybe, unintentionally, we might be hastening his demise, because the dose of morphine that we're giving would impair his pulmonary activity and his ability to breathe. But we're doing our best to prevent that from happening. So even if Kamei Shemaya Galia, only HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows, maybe we did hasten his demise, but that would be considered a mitzvah and not an aveda. So in no way could we justify terminal sedation when our objective and goal is to, yes, we might make it more comfortable for the person and his family. And maybe if we wouldn't be halacha adhering and God-fearing Jews, maybe we would assume that that is the right thing to do, and maybe would assume it is a humane act. But yes, we are people of Sinai, and we adhere to halacha. So according to halachic definition, there would be no justification in any circumstances to hasten and bring forth death in one's demise, even though many others might feel that it's humane and it's the right thing to do. But on the other hand, when our objective is to treat a patient and to ease his pain, being aware that maybe we are hastening and bringing forth his demise, that still would be considered a mitzvah and not an aveir. So we have many questions in our times dealing with end-of-life issues and the treatment of the terminally ill and the suffering. I just want to come back to a question that was presented in our previous discussion, because I have been made aware that maybe I wasn't clear enough when we were speaking about consuming part of the placenta to treat postpartum depression. I just want to make clear that consuming human flesh is an iser, and it's an iser d'oraisa. So we are dealing with an iser. So unless we have reliable and clear criteria and information and data that doing so would prevent grave illness, that would be considered a transgression, that would be considered an iser. Another topic I would like to initiate, it might come up through questions from those gathered, but it is important enough to me to address it, is the topic of vaccination. And I think it is extremely important and imperative that we vaccinate our children. I know that some gedolim have voiced different opinions, and I think it is a mistake. Many times I've been asked, is it a chiyuv to vaccinate your children? Is it a chiyuv? And I think it is. Why would I say it's a chiyuv? Brings us to a very fundamental question. Yes, when the vast majority of the population vaccinates its children, then the few that were not vaccinated are not at a major risk. But that is taking advantage of others to selfishly care for yourselves. So yes, when the vast majority of the population vaccinates their children, though, these diseases are no longer prevalent. So the individual could say it would be quite safe not to vaccinate. But why do you think you are entitled to do so? So when Bays and Paskins, we need to raise money for a worthy cause, each and every member of the community has to participate in that effort. And the individual can say, well, my $100 will be missing. They'll still make it happen. No, you're a part of the community, and you need to bear the burden just as all the others. When a community needs volunteers to patrol the perimeter of the community in Israel, in Judea, in Samaria, in Yerushalayim, in any other settlement, the individual could say, no, I won't participate in Shmira. I won't participate in the patrol. Well, others will do it instead of me. He's not entitled to do so. You're part of the community. You need to bear the brunt, and you just need to do as all the others. And I think the same aloha would apply to vaccination. The individual can't say, let all the others vaccinate their children, and I'll be safe without vaccinating. No. You're part of the community. And if we do know that vaccination is a lifesaver and it's important, then it is upon all the members of society. So I know there are some that argue all kind of strange arguments that vaccination causes autism. I think that has no scientific basis whatsoever, not even anecdotal. So maybe some autistic people weren't vaccinated, but many non-autistic people weren't vaccinated either. And I think as society knows that vaccination is a lifesaver and it's important, I think it is upon each and every member of the community to vaccinate their children. And I think schools are entitled to say that every child in our school should be vaccinated, and schools are entitled to say that we demand this from parents, and parents that will not vaccinate their children would not have any room in our school.
So I'd like to begin with questions on the category of end of life, apropos the last discussion of the Rav. And one very practical question relating specifically to terminal sedation was posed. As part of my work in the hospital, I refuse to perform terminal weaning or terminal sedation on my patients and yield to another physician. Am I permitted to initiate a conversation regarding terminal weaning when patient or family are ignorant of that option?
Yes, doctors today are required to give their patients all the options they have. And I've been asked by doctors from many different medical institutions, could they comply with this? I don't know whether it's law or a regulation, but doctors are required to give their patients the entire spectrum of their options. So is a Froom doctor entitled to just notify his patient that it is an option? And this brings us to questions that I receive from a great spectrum. In our modern world, Froom doctors sometimes have real dilemmas. And their dilemmas sometimes involve their ability to practice medicine. Because if you don't comply and you don't ask in accordance to the law, you might lose your license. So sometimes the halachic dilemma would be extreme. Is a doctor required to lose his license and forego his profession in order not to present the patient with his different options? So I think if that is what the law requires, that is what the doctor has to do. A Froom doctor, a doctor who the halacha is ne'er l'raglav, would do it in a way to comply with the law. But if his patient is Jewish, I think he would present the options in a way in which probably we assume and we hope that the patient would understand what the more reasonable options are from the halachic standpoint. But I think that a doctor does not have to endanger his profession and his license in order just not to present the options to the patient. We're living in a modern world in which patients and their families know that the decision is theirs. So merely by giving the options, I don't think that is a violation of halacha. If I would have my way, I would prefer not giving that option. But if that is what is required, then I think the doctor is entitled to do so.
A number of questions address the other end-of-life treatments. In one question, it was asked, when is it appropriate to put a patient on a ventilator, and when is it halachically okay to remove the ventilator, if ever?
Yes, this is also one of the more painful decisions sometimes patients and families need to make. Once you put a patient on a ventilator, you cannot remove him from that ventilator unless the doctors feel that you could remove him from the ventilator and he has a fair chance of breathing on his own. And if doctors feel that he has a fair chance of breathing on his own, they would definitely want to get him off that ventilator. Being on a ventilator is not very good for your health. It might cause infection, it causes extreme stress, so if doctors feel that the patient will be able to breathe on his own, they will initiate and recommend getting him off the ventilator. If you get him off the ventilator and he's breathing on his own, even if his health deteriorates a day or two later, it would be as if he was never on a ventilator, and we once again need to decide, do we put him on a ventilator or not? My basic ruling, my basic psak questions, when do we need to put a person on a ventilator and when not? If putting him on the machine would just be the last stage before his death, then there is no need to put him on the ventilator. We need to put a person on a ventilator only if there is a chance that the body might rebound and we have a chance of getting him off the ventilator. In that case, we need to put him on the ventilator to let him strengthen and get back to himself, and we have a chance of getting him off that ventilator. But if putting him on the ventilator is merely the last stage between life and death, and I want you to know, you probably are aware that putting a person on a ventilator means intubating and sedating, unless you use a trach. But usually when you have a tube down his throat, he needs to be sedated. So in many cases, it's merely the last stage between life and death. If that is the situation, we do not need to put him on a ventilator.
Just a follow-up question. If the doctors honestly believe the patient can be extubated, removed from the respirator, the Rav said that a day or two later the patient might deteriorate. Let's say the patient deteriorates an hour later, 6 hours later, 12 hours later.
It's very difficult to define with a time frame. I know that people today expect the Rabbonim to be very specific, and sometimes when I'm asked similar questions, what is the time frame, I respond by saying 1 hour, 12 minutes, and 13 halakim. That is more or less the formula we use once a month by Berachas HaChodesh when we say how many minutes and how many halakim, but that is not the way halacha talks. So it's very difficult to give a specific time frame. If you take him on the ventilator and the deterioration is immediate, then you need to put him right back on the ventilator, because that is not considered taking him off the ventilator. But I think the doctors suggested, for their medical reasons, to take him off the ventilator, and he was doing fine even a few hours later. If it deteriorates, it is as if he was never on the ventilator, and we need to deal with the question, is it justified to put him on the ventilator or not?
The next question is about feeding tubes. When someone is at the end of life, what are the halachic implications of inserting a permanent feeding tube? Once it is in, must it continue to be used?
I think feeding tubes, in a way, would be similar to ventilators, even though I know that many Rabbonim argue food is different. I don't think food is different than oxygen or a ventilator, because by nature, we don't have feeding tubes. By nature, people eat through their mouths. So opening one's stomach and having food put directly into a stomach in a way would be similar to any other surgical procedure. So in many cases, the doctors, from their medical point of view, have a very definitive opinion about using feeding tubes, because sometimes people at their end of life cannot really digest food, and not always is it medically advisable using a feeding tube. Once again, if using that feeding tube would merely mean prolonging his life with another few hours or another few days, there would be no need to do so. But if we could sustain his health, and he might bounce back, and we might be able to sustain his health in getting that feeding tube out, in that case, it would be imperative, it would be a chiyuv to using that feeding tube.
The next question relates to donating the body to science. In this particular case, a patient requested in writing that he wanted his body donated to science. The family was averse to that particular request. It's a question about the halachic permissibility of donating and navigating such a situation with the family.
Well, this question goes back 250 years to the Noi de Bihuda and the Chsam Sofer. And the Noi de Bihuda and the Chsam Sofer deal specifically with this question, because obviously anatomy was always part of research. And this goes back many, many years before we had the know-how to do really surgical procedures, but it was far easier to operate on the dead than on the living. So this was part of research going back hundreds of years. And the Noi de Bihuda, we find this question, the Noi de Bihuda says, no, it cannot be permitted. and the Chsam Sofer supports the same opinion, and the Binyan Tzion, so three great halachic authorities going back 200 and 150 years have the same opinion. So the definition of the Noi de Bihuda and the Chsam Sofer is, there is no pikuach nefesh lefaneinu. It is, you know, doing research. Ultimately, maybe the advancement of medicine is a lifesaver, but that is not immediate, and it is not right here and now. And the Chazon Ish in Yerodeah has an interesting comment, and he argues it doesn't really matter whether the chole is here, but immediacy is the name of the game. So in our day and age, you know, you take an organ out of a patient in America and you fly it to Israel, you fly it from one, you know, end part of the globe to another, crossing continents and oceans. So it is not bifaneinu, but nevertheless, that would be defined as pikuach nefesh. The advancement of medicine would not be defined as pikuach nefesh, and therefore, based on the psak of the Noi de Bihuda, one is not entitled to donate his body to medicine. I recently gave a psak to Hatzolah in South Africa, which I think was a groundbreaking psak, and it was a big chiddush, but I don't think we have time to discuss it at length. But there was a new regulation in the South Africa that you cannot be a member in Hatzolah or a paramedic unless you serve a month in one of the state medical facilities in Johannesburg or in any other South Africa city. I don't know whether many of you are familiar with the South African Jewry or with South Africa in general, but South Africa has one of the highest, the horrendous AIDS epidemics, and it is extremely unlikely that you'll ever encounter a Jewish patient in a public facility in South Africa. And there are many private facilities in which Jews would be. So serving Shabbos in a public facility definitely would require Chil Shabbos without any heter of pikuach nefesh. And the authorities were very unbudging and uncompromising when approached by the Jewish community that that they should exempt the service of Shabbos. And, you know, they're willing to serve other days of the week, but they were uncompromising. So would it be permissible to serve in a public medical facility on Chilul Shabbos, knowing that if we don't do so, 5 years down the road, not right now, but another few years, we will have no Hatzalah. And Hatzalah in South Africa is far more essential than in New York or in Teaneck or anywhere else in the world, because the public medical services are horrendous. And I gave a heter, because I brought many sources in which even future pikuach nefesh is relevant. But that does not apply to research. You know, doing research, the results and the Hatzalah might be so far down the road, and sometimes it might lead to nowhere. So it would not be permissible for one to donate his body to medical research.
First of all, I apologize. There's lots of wonderful questions. We're not going to have time to get to all the questions because we have to be very punctual to complete the session at 12:45. But on a related question, there in the United States, to train in medicine, there are special residencies called Shomer Shabbos residencies. So if you're a medical student today and you have an opportunity to do both a Shomer Shabbos or a non-Shomer Shabbos, what is preferable? Are you obligated to do a non-Shomer Shabbos or a Shomer Shabbos? Can you do a non-Shomer Shabbos and try and observe Shabbos in that format?
Yes. I know that many medical students would prefer the more prestigious universities that don't have a Shomer Shabbos program, but I think if you have a Shomer Shabbos program, you must opt for the Shomer Shabbos program, because serving Shabbos in medical facilities and hospitals in America have great, great halachic questions. I wish we would have Shomer Shabbos programs in Eretz Yisrael, but we don't. So the hospitals and medical facilities in Israel argue they can't have a Shomer Shabbos program because, Baruch Hashem, the situation is such that the frum community is growing in leaps and bounds, and if any hospital will have a Shomer Shabbos program, then there will be very few doctors that will be working on Shabbos, and those that will be working on Shabbos by the vast majority will be our cousins, so many of us will feel... There are some great Arab doctors in Israel, and I mean it. There's some of them are great, and some of them are very, very good doctors, and I believe that many of them care for human life. But nevertheless, many people would feel very uncomfortable in hospitals, so I wish we would have Shomer Shabbos residencies in Israel, but we don't. But I think in America, if you could have a Shomer Shabbos program, you should do that.
Regarding the case of the Chazon Ish and the arrow, it has now become actually halacha lemaisa, because now many companies are creating automatic cars, self-driving cars that are computerized. And one option in the car is that the person is about to get into an accident, and there's many people on one side, and the other option is for the driver to be killed. And they're pre-programming the car. How should the car be pre-programmed?
I am actually dealing with a question, and I'm in the middle of writing a tshuva. Now, I must confess, I was not approached by Google. But I was approached by scientists working on the program, and they wanted to know what Halacha has to say about this. And it is a fascinating discussion, and I'm actually right now in the middle of writing a tshuva on it, and it is a fascinating question. I just wonder whether many people will drive a car knowing that the car they're driving would ditch them off the cliff to save others. What would be the market implications of this technology? Which is an interesting question. But yes, it is a fascinating question. I actually rode with someone. Some European car makers already have autonomous cars. So a person was driving me with a new Volvo, and he was just sitting back, and we were in heavy traffic, and the car went from one lane to the other with no intervention at all from the driver. He was just sitting back, didn't touch the brakes, didn't touch the steering wheel, and the car was amazing, like Al Yedei Shem. Moved from one lane to the other, and I was just sitting there. It was mind-boggling. But that is only the very, very raw implications. This technology is advancing, and in the very near future, we will have autonomous cars that will speed down the roads. And this poses very fascinating halacha questions. But I think we'll have time to deal with that question in our next time we meet.
Thank you very much. That concludes our wonderful session for today. We're going to talk about the minutes in about 2 minutes of the group for those who want to stay. Michael is emergency medicine. I'm very close to the friend of mine. And I have friends translating drugs.